This podcast was recorded on Bundjalung land of the Arakwal Nation. What's up, everybody? My name is Luca Lesson, and this is the Future Ancients podcast. I'd like to send a shout out to my patrons, those legendary human beings who have afforded me the gift of time by supporting me through donating a small amount of money to my Patreon page to help me as an independent artist stay independent and stay creative during these wild times. It's been an amazing year of finding this support and connecting with my patrons directly, and I really appreciate them. And as always, this episode is brought to you by my patrons. This episode of the podcast is with the great Hala Abdel Noor. She is a really legendary human being, someone that I've known for a long time since I first moved to Melbourne in 2010. And even though I'm not there anymore, I really feel connected and have stayed connected with her during these years where I've seen her flourish and grow through an organization called Global Echoes. And recently I was in touch with her and we decided that we would make a collaboration happen so that she could launch her new organization called the Institute of Nonviolence. She's focusing on domestic violence and violence against women or gendered violence and tackling that in ways that I find are really grounded and powerful. We decided to come together and create something together. So while she launched her organization, we also launched a new video and poem called A Letter to My Daughter that I wrote especially for this occasion. Hala and I talked about her new organization, the Institute of Nonviolence, and where it's heading, my process of writing this poem and how it all came together, but also in general, gendered violence, the UN International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, which was November 25th, and the 16 days of activism following. Since we recorded this podcast and I finally am now uploading it for you all, something very disturbing has happened. And that is that in Australia alone, on Monday just past, so just a few days ago, during the 16 days of activism around the world, three women were killed in one day by domestic violence through their partners. In Australia. This is a horrendous statistic. Crazy that it has not been reported anywhere near as much as so many other things get reported. For some reason, women's lives are still not being taken seriously, or somehow domestic violence is being normalized to the point where it's not even something that lands on the front page of a newspaper when something like this happens. And so it's just evidence that we need to keep pushing and that we need to keep having these conversations and writing and connecting and telling these stories as much as possible. And as a man, I find that it's important that the responsibility to tell these stories does not fall on the shoulders of women, and that we all take responsibility in some part for a telling of these stories, a grounding in these stories, a connecting and doing our part, doing our bit to make sure not only that we talk out and we be activists and we, you know, go for these big kind of aims of changing the world, but also just with inside ourselves as men, we have these conversations constantly with ourselves. We think about how we're teaching each other, our children, and how we're relating to other men around us and the conversations that we're having between us. I think that this is really important as well, to get to the nucleus, to get to the crux of the issue and stop it before it happens. Either way, this was a really powerful episode and I hope that you all enjoy this, the latest episode with Hala Abdel Noor of the Future Ancients podcast. Hala, Welcome to the Future Ancients Poetry Podcast of a Lifetime. How are you?
Oh man, I'm good. It's good to be here.
It's very good to be here. Finally, we made it happen. We made it work. We're together in the same place, not in the same place, but we're online at the same time, which is nice. And I'm really excited to talk to you about this. We've been working on this collaboration behind closed doors for, will we say months? We could say months, couldn't we?
Easy.
My goodness. And the biggest part of it really is not my part of it. The biggest part of it is your part of it, which is the launch of Institute of Nonviolence. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we're launching the Institute of Nonviolence today. And it, on purpose, we chose the 25th of November, which is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And it's also the first day of the 16 days of activism. So for the next 16 days, we hope to do some stuff with you and some stuff at our end as well, and just spread the message to end violence against women, to end gendered violence, but also to invite people to get to know the Institute of Nonviolence, to jump on our website, to have a look at what we think is a really cool collection of resources we've put together there, and some information, and check out our services, which, you know, are a project that will continue to grow and change. But we're pretty excited to be official in the world.
Yeah, awesome. Congratulations. Amazing. This is not your first organizational baby, not your first rodeo, as they say.
It's not my first rodeo. I rodeoed a long time ago. It's been almost 20 years that I started doing cultural competency training at a very young age, starting with the Arabic community and then, or Arabic culture training, and then more broadly about working with migrants and refugees. And because I was getting a lot of work in my 20s doing that, I registered an ABN, which became a private business, which is Global Echo Consultants. And Global Echo served a beautiful purpose when I was just focused on diversity and inclusion, interculture, interfaith, dialogue, and anti-racism work, which I still do. I still incorporate that. Global Echo is not dead. It's actually the parent company. It's co-parenting the Institute of Nonviolence with me. Like I had a baby.
Awesome. I feel like a stepdad now.
You are.
Step uncle.
And you know what they say, it takes a village to raise a child. So I
I'm glad to be here for the baptism today.
We are baptized.
Out to me a little while ago, and we decided to work together around creating a poem for this particular day, for this particular launch, and focused on the aims of the Institute of Nonviolence and talking about and raising more discussion around eradicating violence against women. And I was stoked for so many reasons, because one of them is that I've always wanted to work with an organization, or if I ever was to work with an organization, I didn't want it to be like, yeah, I'm going to write a poem for Nike or for Adidas, but I want to write a poem or a piece for a movement, for a process, for a conversation, for something that really uplifts society in some way or another, and that has some grounding by working with somebody who knows much more than me about that particular issue or about that particular topic. So being a poet's an interesting thing, because I write a lot about a lot of different things, but of course you can talk a lot, but I never really want to write about something that I know I have no idea about, but I just researched for 20 minutes and just tried to make something cool. I want to feel like I'm at least relating the poem to my life, to my heritage, to my family, to my experience as a human being, to who I am. But also I know that poetry and art can be so influential, but sometimes people feel like there's a limit to it. Like it gets them riled up and excited and they want to do something, but then they kind of get dropped off the edge of a cliff and go, all right, now you go figure out what you're going to do with all that energy and with all that good vibe. Whereas this what excited me about our collaboration is that I get to write something, people get to feel inspired, and then there is a whole world of information and opportunity to co-create or connect with you and to connect with the Institute of Nonviolence to further their passion, to give their passion somewhere to go, to somewhere to be applied. So that was really what excited me about it. And we'd known each other from when I was living in Melbourne for a while anyway. So there was already trust there. So it made sense for me to work in this way with you. And I'm actually doing a number of these things, not just with yourself, with Institute of Nonviolence, but also next month I'm releasing something with 2040, with another organization that focus on climate change and focus. They have a documentary called 2040, which imagines what the world could be like if we just used all the technology we already have, all the information we already have. What could the world be like in 2040 if the gatekeepers helped us become as sustainable as possible?
I've seen it and it's awesome. And I think what you're saying is really important, because big issues are overwhelming. And we talk about, you know, whether it's climate change, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's engendered violence. These are massive issues, and people feel like, what can I as an individual do? And we can easily go into a space of saying, well, I didn't create this problem, so why do I have to be responsible to end it? And, you know, it's about one understanding we're not alone, and no one's asking any one person to do anything on their own. And in fact, we actually have to do this as a society, as a community of humans. So, you know, and the next step of that is knowing what to do. And I think campaigners, activists figured that out a while ago, that it's not enough just to drum up emotions and passion for topics, but people want an action to come with it. So,
yeah, I think it's important. Like, I used to be, used to be an academic, teaching in university, and I fell in love with this concept of edutainment, you know, this idea of educating through entertaining means of, you know, I wrote a thesis and I know that it's sitting on some bookshelf somewhere at Monash University that no one reads, or maybe one person reads a year. No, I'm not a doctor. I'm a master. I have an honors. I have an honors and a master's. So, but I also felt as though that information stays on a bookshelf, you know, and it doesn't get to necessarily influence the national psyche or the international or the psyche of people around the world. And I felt as though that it was stuck there in a way. But now as an artist, and I would call myself, you know, an artist more so than an academic, definitely now, it's also important that, yeah, if I'm drumming up emotions and I'm drumming up support for something, that there is in some way a responsibility that where I point people and where I lead them, that there's a responsible kind of end game in that sense, that it's not just like, which I think is not necessarily not powerful at all, but to say, hey, everybody, look at this gendered violence, 16 days of activism, use a hashtag, or, you know, like, you know, be nice to a lady this week, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like these things aren't gonna last, you know? So I felt like it was really cool to be able to, I feel in some ways safer as an artist to be able to go, here's my art and here is what you can do with that art. Here's where you can go with it in a responsible way with people that know what the hell they're doing. And how it should be implemented, how that, you know, work should be implemented. And so I think that's important, because I think I see a lot of, I mean, nowhere near, not like me, but like super, super famous people who they kind of jump on some issue and they don't necessarily do the research, or they don't necessarily connect with the right organization, or they don't really realize that beneath certain organizations, there is just another culture of hierarchy and racism and racial structure issues within their structures or whatever it might be. And so they have a lot of people supporting something that is not necessarily ethical in the end.
Right.
And so as artists, I feel like it's important for us to be just a little bit more responsible if we can, when we can, to make sure that the people that we're leading down the rabbit hole, that they're led somewhere decent, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to two important issues. One is accessibility. And you're talking about making the information, edutainment, making it more accessible for people. So not everyone will read a thesis. Not everyone can interact with a thesis. But most people can react with poetry, songs, storytelling. These are things that are innate in all of us. We've all come from an ancestry that embraced storytelling. So that definitely makes it more accessible. And it's certainly one of the objectives as I was creating the website for the Institute of Nonviolence and thinking about, as a business, where do I want it placed? It's looking at, well, government exists and they do the policy, and the not-for-profits exist and they deliver the programs, and they kind of have to stick to a certain language around these things and a way of doing it. And I thought, well, let's fill a bit of a gap where we can make all of that more accessible to the community. And a big part of that was you know, wanting to it's just serendipitous how it happened, but I love that we've got a poem and that's how we're launching.
Totally. And that it works in
because
a way
it
that
speaks to that.
Yeah. And that it just worked kind of fluidly, and it works in a way where the art feeds into the message and the message feeds into the research that you've done and the work that you're doing. And it just, it's basically like a continuation of the conversation instead of leaving people kind of up in the air. Poems can only really be, you know, I mean, they can be 30 hours long, like the Odyssey is, but
wow. Yeah,
they can also be 3 minutes long. And the Odyssey is really, you know, 30 hours is, you know what I mean? Like it's a connection of 103-minute poems, you know, it's just like lots of little sections.
Sure.
But the other thing, I think it's important to understand that I can't write I could write a thesis and make a video clip for it. You know what I mean? But even then it's not going to be watched. So it's about this 3 minute time limit of a slam poem seems to be this kind of sweet spot in the world today where we can really connect with people and feel something and share something.
Look, and something you've talked about quite a bit is being personable. And, you know, it through poetry, you can be yourself. You can write from the heart. You can speak to your passions. You can speak to your personal experiences and lived experiences, which I think is extremely valid when we're trying to engage the community in a conversation about family violence, because I would say just about every single one of us has been touched by violence in some way. And I'd go as far as saying that just because so many people in the world are touched by violence, we're indirectly all touched by it. When we look at the cumulative impact, the long-term impacts of violence on children who grow up in those homes, somebody who as an adult experienced it, some significant trauma, these things play out in the way we then are in the world. And we might work with that person. We might be their friend. We might be a relative. So, speaking from the heart and from lived experiences about this issue is very valid and very relevant.
Yeah.
And the other thing you talked about is being responsible and being ethical. And that's a massive label to put on a business in particular. So, you know, and I've sort of been around the world of ethical enterprise for a number of years. And I would like other people to say whether I'm ethical or not. I don't think that I want to apply that label to myself. And that's part of doing this work in family violence is remaining reflective, never stopping to reflect on how.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And even as with me as an artist, you know, like that I don't see it as a noun so much as a verb, you know, of understanding that an ethical anything is for me like self-reflective, is for me like there isn't, because I would worry that what's ethical, like you get the stamp of ethical today and in 20 years it's not ethical anymore because of
in 2 years
because of what's changed and grown and how, you know, we're learning together, or what's ethical for one community is unethical for another community that you're working with, and you're working with them on the same topic. So yes, continuing to learn, but I also think that there is a very distinct difference between an organization that there's a concept called disaster capitalism. I don't know if you've know much about that yet. So this idea that we're not working. In some ways, I feel like the most important thing, especially when I'm doing work with in community or with young people, or you know, it's always in community. No matter where I am, I'm involved in some kind of connection with people. That if I'm in a process of like teaching somebody something, my end game is to not need a job very soon, to put myself out of a job by training that person to the point where I'm no longer needed, not inculcating the disaster or in some ways not supporting, but basically making money from the oppression or making money from the problem that I'm being sent to assist or being sent to help.
Yeah.
Because then the problem never ends and I stay employed.
Yeah.
And that's nice and secure, you know, for someone who goes into certain places and works like that. But it is, I find it so counterintuitive and so counter just unethical and so, you know, out of my realm that I would somehow want to stay in a position forever and keep people in the position of victim or whatever it might be forever as well, you know, and somehow my presence might contribute to that. So that's what I mean. There's some organizations that really don't reflect on that at all. And that's not necessarily to say that they are evil, but that they perhaps are so big that they can't move with the nuance of the context that they're involved in. And there's other organizations that are not so robotic in a way, or not, they're not so based on the oppression, but based on how do we, you know, move towards freedom and how do we give people that freedom? And then how do we adapt and move to change and be different once that certain thing is starting to be resolved? Where do we go next?
Yeah. You know, and I think you used the word safe before, and that's something that, you know, definitely I strive for people to feel safe, especially when we're having a conversation about violence. And you felt safe as an artist that your art form will be protected by working with me. You felt safe as a man to write a piece as a man about women, you know, violence, men's violence towards women. And you know, we do a lot of training, for example, professional training. So it could be basic foundational family violence training, and it could be advanced for practitioners who work in the space and everything in between. And whether we're delivering training, having a conversation like this, releasing poetry, whatever it is, it's impossible to talk about something like family violence or gendered violence without triggering. And so the importance of safety just becomes central to the work that we do.
That's the foundation. Otherwise it doesn't work from there.
Right. And it's just being mindful of the language we use. It's being mindful of the approach. It's being mindful of being open, you know, and I think that speaks to some of those organizational structures you're talking about of what we want to avoid is becoming too rigid or too caught up in our own dialogue internally that we're actually starting to exclude people, or that dialogue just isn't accessible, you know, or it's not safe for everyone. And that's a very difficult balance to achieve, but it's certainly one that I strive for all the time. Absolutely. So it warms my heart when you say you felt safe to work with me on this project. That's awesome.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I guess it's because of Global Echoes and the connections that we've had in the past before anyway. And I wanted to really know if there was a Venn diagram between Global Echoes and anti-racism work that you've been doing for a very long time and Institute of Nonviolence and this work that you're heading into. What, there must have been some kind of crossover for you to think that this is a whole other area we need to look at that somehow sits within the Global Echoes anti-racism and you know, unity kind of work. What is that meeting point? Where do those two worlds meet?
Yeah, look, it was such a natural and organic transition, you know, in that I about for the past 5 years or so have been very focused on family violence work specifically, whilst I've still and actually part of entering into the world of family violence was as a diversity and inclusion consultant. My experience over about 20 years of working in the community sector is that the services, whether it's drug and alcohol, gambling, mental health, whatever it is, tends to underservice culturally diverse communities. And Australia is a very diverse country. Our populations are so culturally diverse. Our First Nations people are culturally, you know, its origins are cultural diversity and different language and faith affiliations. So I felt like it's important to tap into those spaces and make sure that we're including everyone in the service delivery. Because when it comes to family violence, if we don't service migrant and refugee communities, and I know there's a lot happening that's community led and community driven in the Aboriginal space, which is fantastic. But if we let go of, if we underservice migrant and refugee communities, that's actually more women and children dying. And we're saying it's okay for them to, and no one's saying it's okay, but we need to get up to speed with that. So I started doing work with perpetrators. I used to work in prison in the past and as a drug and alcohol counsellor. So I wasn't new to the world of working with violent men or men who use violence, I'd prefer to say, whether it's general violence or family violence.
Mm.
And it was just this natural transition. It's whether, you know, it's systemic violence, any system of oppression. So we look at intersectionality, we apply intersectionality in our work at the Institute, which is primarily looking at how social structures are designed and systems are designed where you might have multiple intersections of oppression. So being a woman is a disadvantage. Being a person of color is a disadvantage. Living with a disability is a disadvantage because the system disadvantages those things. If you're a woman of color living with a disability or identifying as queer, or, you know, there's a number of things that are disadvantaged by the current system, you find yourself at crossroads, at intersections, where the system's oppressing you in multiple ways and coming out of that is difficult. And family, the experience of family violence and the use of family violence are both impacted by those intersections of oppression. And that's the core of the niche of the work of the Institute of Nonviolence. And we, you know, want to apply that model broadly to policymakers, to the service providers, and to businesses who want to better support their employees who might be using or experiencing family violence or down the track. I guess by naming it the Institute of Nonviolence, I had two things came to mind. One is, I don't want to talk about violence. I want to talk about nonviolence because that's our essence. That's our core. And we are essentially nonviolent beings. Mother Nature is essentially nonviolent, but violence happens within that. And the other thing is that under the Institute of Nonviolence, I can merge those two worlds together down the track. I don't want to dictate that now. I don't want to know. I don't want to say this is exactly what will happen and when. Global Echo might continue to run on its own. Institute will run. But if I wanted to merge the two, because under the Institute of Nonviolence, we look at systemic forms of violence, which gendered violence is related to.
So I really love the language that you're using that I don't think many people use. And I don't think that has become normal in society as yet. But I really love how you don't say someone who is a victim of domestic violence or gendered violence. You say someone experiencing violence or someone using violence. So you're not defining human beings entirely by their experience of being hurt by violence or being experiencing the violence. So it's not like she is or she was or he is or she was or she he was or whatever. It's like a victim or suffered from or whatever. It's an experience which is transient. It's not forever,
and it right
from forever, from the first moment you were born. It's not your identity.
Life is transient, isn't it? It's dynamic. I mean, you might be experiencing violence at one point in your life, and you very well will feel victimized by that, and you will have those impacts by it. In another space, you might find yourself using violence towards other people.
Doesn't define you.
No, that's right. It doesn't define you. And I think it's important that we don't define our being by our experiences in life, nor our behavior. So I've spent a lot of time working in men's behavior change programs, and I would go as far, and you can't say every single male, but it feels like every single guy that comes to group within the first 2 or 3 weeks is just almost repeatedly saying, I'm not violent. I'm not a bad guy. Stop telling me I'm a bad guy. Like, you know, I'm not bad. And it's that I, and it's that attachment. You know, when we sort of approach behaviors that are not safe, we approach them with such a punitive model. We attach the behavior to the person. We say, you are a perpetrator.
You are a criminal. You are a abuser.
And it's really important that we honor the impact on people from those behaviors, and that we don't tone it down, you know, for the person that, hey, these behaviors are not okay and they do need to change, but you are not your behavior. Yeah. You are somebody. You are an entire being that has thoughts and feelings, and you are not your thoughts. You are not your feelings. You're not your behaviors. That's why you can change them. But you can't change your core essence. It's something you're born with. And that's getting philosophical.
But I think it's really important, because I would imagine there would be some kind of backlash from certain parts of the community that I think we are very much inculcated into this idea of punitive, you know, revenge almost to certain things. And it's so interesting because in Australia, I don't know if the statistics are still the same, but a woman dies from domestic violence once a week in Australia still, if not more than once a week.
It's 2 women a week.
Yes. So it's this incredibly huge thing that is getting treated as nowhere near as important as many other things that people are dying from or experiencing. The reaction from society, or the reaction from government, or the reaction from policymakers, or whatever, is, for me, in my mind, and I think a lot of people's minds, is just nowhere near equal to the reality of what's happening. And so I think a lot of people get very angry when certain things are reported in the media, that a man has done this to his family or whatever it might be, and their reaction is, you know, death penalty or lock him up, or, you know, like this kind of stuff as well, which I understand that people go for, you know, straight away. But it feels like what you're talking about is really healing. It's like actually healing society one man at a time, one behavior at a time, one experience at a time, and one, you know, person who's experienced it, and whatever trauma they might be carrying as well, and the traumas that make people act in violent ways, those underlying traumas.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the work. Like, that's really the work. And it's not like this simple quick fix. It is a practice, and it is.
Sorry, Luca.
No, I was just going to say it's a practice, and it's one at a time. You know, it's like one little experience at a time, one moment, one aha moment at a time, one awakening at a time.
Look, and I'd say yes, and to that, in a sense that there is a short-term response and a long-term response.
Yeah.
And I certainly think that our long-term response needs to be more about rehabilitation, more about compassion and embracing the ability to change and the will to change. In the short term, if somebody's so unsafe for their family that their lives are at risk, we also have to intervene.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult balance. You know, that's an ongoing conversation that we can't stop having, you know, because one person's responsible for the violence in the moment, but I also feel like that person's a product of society. And so all of society is responsible for violence. That's including all of us. And it takes multiple people to intervene when violence exists in a family. It's not a quick solution at all. And the person using the violence needs to be willing to make those changes, and they are, to varying degrees. So when you're working with someone who's endangering their family and is not at all in a headspace to change their behavior, we have to think about our intervention in that moment in the short term, compared to someone who's saying, yes, I do want to change. So I don't feel like
100%.
We buy the same tool.
But I guess the difficulty is, who makes that decision?
That's right.
How do we make that decision? How do we know when someone's showing the behavior that could escalate or that is immediately dangerous? And, you know, how do we know when it's a real commitment to change and there's right. a safe space that's been created?
And this is something sort of for what we call the family violence specialist sector and the specialist services, where there is access to the knowledge and the research around those things. And it's all always, you know, it is a dynamic and open conversation, but bringing it back to everybody in the community and what they can do. When I say someone using violence is a product of society, it's a society that puts women at the butt of jokes. It's okay to circulate derogatory jokes about women. We laugh at them. Sexist jokes, sexualized jokes. It's a society that feels okay about advertising any product. Products that have nothing to do with sex and nothing to do with female. In fact, the less they have to do with sex and females, the more they use females in a sexualized form to advertise those products. That's speaking to a male audience. That's sending out a massive message. And there's a video about ads by Jean Kilbourne on our website that we shared just to drive that point across. TV advertising, TV shows, movies, the sexualization of women in the media in general is so normalized and is so common that it takes every single one of us to stop interacting with that, to say no to it, to say to the advertisers, I want something else from you. And that will be really powerful. From a systemic, from a government perspective and a legal perspective, I think that there needs to be a massive nudge, let's call it.
You're so nice.
To act on the porn industry, because we know for a fact that the porn industry drives violence towards women and sexualized violence in particular. It does not do men any favors in terms of understanding themselves as sexual beings, understanding their own bodies and their own needs. And at the same time, drives a behavior that's very violent towards women and children. You know, so there are massive things. And then there are like I said, back to the jokes I was talking about, just don't circulate it the next time. Lose that friend who thinks you're not cool because you went, hey man, this is not okay. I will not circulate these jokes. And the more of us that do that, the more people will stop and think, well, why aren't these jokes okay? How am I impacted? You know, why do we never joke about men in the same way we joke about women? Why don't we ever joke about white people in the way we joke about black people? You know, it's sort of who's at the butt end of jokes is the person who's most oppressed in society by that thing. And so it's by stopping that we contribute. We contribute in so many ways. We contribute by wearing orange today, taking a photo and posting it online and saying, hey, I think that violence against women is not cool and I want it to stop. You know, and I'm starting by this. I'm starting here.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I mean, there's so many important points on what you just said, but one of them is that it is a multi-pronged approach and to any form of activism or any form of social change. I've really felt like, especially when I was living in Melbourne, actually there felt like there was some kind of a hierarchy between how you're doing it and how I'm doing it and how it should be done and how this, you know, is ways that it should be done. And this person says it should be like this. But I understand that, you know, there are many different ways of approaching things and that we try and do the best, try and apply the best tool in the right moment, in the right context. But that, yeah, little things do make a difference. Little things like not telling a joke or posting about, you know, something, or wearing orange today or for the next 16 days or whatever it might be. Those little things, just to have another conversation, do actually shift social understandings around issues. And then there's other things that seem much bigger, maybe, or, you know, grand kind of gestures that do impact more people or possibly in a deeper way, less people or whatever it might be, but that it all is cumulative, like it all does, just like all the negative stuff is cumulative, so is all of this stuff. And
right, exactly.
I think that's awesome to hear how you can see all of those things happening and find a balance within, you know, like for instance, before you were saying that if porn is doing certain things to men's brains or ideas around sexuality and violence within sexuality, But as well, you know, this other factor is contributing and this other factor is contributing and that other factor is contributing, then I think that means that some people will go, well, I'm going to take on this part of that issue rather than this kind of broad, you know, I'm over this thing. I'm going to wear orange and do a hashtag and then forget about it because it's so big. I don't know where to start. But if there are sections, then maybe that's actually better to identify the different sections of this. I was talking to a friend of mine on an earlier episode of the podcast around sexual health, and we were talking about sex ed in schools and how sex ed is not really sex ed because there's nothing really sexy about it. It's not really about discovering your bodies or pleasure or love, or it's actually biology class. It's like biology for making humans. Like that's all it is. It's like it's reproductive biology. If you, you know, put on a condom, this happens. If you don't, that happens. And when this happens, that goes there and this goes there. And then you're a dad, you know, like it's not really.
Or a mom.
Yeah, or a mom. It's not really so much around healthy sexuality. Absolutely. And I think that porn basically fills this space where our society refuses to talk openly with young people around healthy forms of sexuality. And so whatever sells in that space sells and proliferates and goes around the world and becomes the thing that people engage with, because there isn't really a healthy alternative to the level that the porn industry has become, you know.
Oh, look, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think that it's also about recognizing that we are sexual beings and not just going, this is bad, like in an old kind of, you know, very
dogmatic
kind of, no, don't sin. And then in some ways I think that encourages more violence and frustration among us and among men, and in some ways makes you more susceptible to being out of control, maybe. I don't know, what would you call it, that this repression of something always tends to amplify it, this kind of human nature that whatever we try and stop, you know, ourselves from doing in this very dogmatic way, instead of observing it and understanding ourselves and really understanding what's underneath it, but this kind of rigid, like, I will not do this again. It's like almost praying for it to happen again, whatever it might be.
It is. And this is where we come back to why being reflective in life, not just as a business, but as a person, is so essential. Because if that was, you know, a great sort of insight, you know, I guess, you know, even into your own thoughts, which I'm sure are shared by others, about how you're impacted by a society as a man that tells you, don't do this, don't do that, here's a porn industry. And so then you engage in, I'm not saying you do personally, but like that you engage in sex violently. And that's where you have to go, hang on a second, because you know, I'm just sort of touching on that word out of control, because men say that a lot. I just need to control myself. Mm. And it's actually a choice. It's a choice to engage. You know, every time you sit down to watch porn, it's violent. At some level in your body, you know that. And if you don't know it, and then someone tells you it, and you ignore that and continue to watch because there's no other, there are options, they're just harder to find, and it's about not being lazy. And those options for healthier sexual interaction, which was a lot more equal between men and women, come from the ancient world. The Kama Sutra book of life, it's not just it's one chapter on sexual interaction, but it's actually a book of life, because sexuality is a part of life. The ancient Greeks, which I know you're very connected with, you know, a lot of the ancient shamanic cultures and other things saw sex very differently. And yes, we don't talk about it in the modern world, but it is a choice to engage or disengage. It is a choice to listen to the woman and listen to women en masse who say, this is not doing it for me. Like, this is not how we want to be treated. This isn't okay. And knowing that you absolutely can control your choices, your thoughts and your behaviors, if you want to.
Interesting.
And we're out there, you know, people like the Institute on Violence and people like us, we're out there more and more trying to share information about how people can make a safer choice in how they interact.
Mm. Wow, there's so much in that to unpack. I'm going to have to do another 10 episodes.
I feel the same. I want to say when you were talking before, it was, you know, about being a man around these things. I was thinking about what I love about the poem you've written is that you are a man. It is written from a man's perspective. It's called A Letter to My Daughter. And you reflect so much on your great-grandmother's real life experiences in the village in Greece. And that's so powerful. We need more men to do these things, whether it's through art form or whatever their means is, to actually engage other men in a conversation about the women that is, start with the women that are really important to you. And daughter is number one for every guy I've ever met. Even if they had a bad experience with their mother, they had a good, they care about their daughter. So you know, it's finding that connection with other, and I don't want to, I wish we didn't other each other so much, but if there's men and women or male and female, and there are things in between that too, that I don't want to ignore or deny. That whatever you think is not you, that you find a connecting point with it, because particularly around men's violence towards women, men need to connect with women in a loving way. Men also need to have compassion for women, to listen to them when they say, we've had enough, we're dying, it's a gendered issue. Don't take it personally. Understand why. We're not pointing a finger at you, but we want you to stand with us and say, stop it.
Yes, it's so important. And being with my wife, who's from Chile for 6 years, learning a lot about femicide and the stories in Central and South America is also like next level compared to what we see. Not that it's like I'm going to put anything on a pedestal or not.
There's no hierarchy of violence.
Every act of violence is an act of violence, but there's definitely more acts of violence per capita in some parts of the world. And to see Chilean women definitely, you know, as in many ways leaders in some sense of this movement, and to be able to, I was lucky enough when I was in Chile to help someone translate a report that had been done around gendered violence just randomly. And yeah, learning a lot about how those systems work or don't work, and how many, you know, acts of violence, or how many women try and report things, and how many of those reports are actually acted upon, and how many of those that are acted upon actually result in a conviction, and the statistics just drop like immediately. Like you can have, a lot of people saying a lot, but if the systems don't work and don't act on it and don't believe and don't, you know, put it as an important act that needs to be, you know, chased up on, or needs to be the police officers take it seriously. If they don't take it seriously, then it can't be eradicated from that side of the argument. You know, it needs to be still coming from the bottom up, coming from the people up. And slowly things are changing, because there's a global conversation around it, I think, at the moment, that brings a lot of power to the conversation.
That's right.
But yeah, being able to learn Spanish really also has helped me enter into a whole other world, that a whole other, you know, few billion people in the world, that I then get to hear the next level, you know, another story around the same issue, which has really been really powerful for me to hear. And yeah, like you say, relating it to people that you know, or the other that you know, that doesn't feel like an other, you know, at all. It feels like it is a part of you, or someone that you care about enough that, you know, all of a sudden, hopefully a switch gets flicked and a light gets turned on. That was really the intention with the poem.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I just want to, you know, we're probably running out of time, but what as you were saying that too, I really, really, really started thinking about Australia's Aboriginal population and how othered they are. And what you described happening in Chile is actually what's going on for Aboriginal women in particular. And I know Jira Foundation does so much work around that. You know, when Antoinette Braybrook, the CEO, went all the way to the UN to talk about these issues. The silencing of the homicide, femicide and suffering of Aboriginal women in this country is obnoxious. And
totally.
you know, and it's just to kind of pay tribute to that and you know, acknowledge that you and I are on Aboriginal lands, and I know we do acknowledge that, but I just want to say that now we're doing this work here, and not to silence that. And Aboriginal Australians are such a small percentage of the population that they are an other for so many people. You know, like, you can connect with a daughter or a mother, but you not most people don't have an Aboriginal person in their family. So it's actually, I do invite people to connect with this land a bit more, connect with how it is that we've established these institutions here, what the history of that was. Because I fundamentally believe that we can't heal one violence at a time. We have to look at violence as a systemic process, starting with invasion, starting with the genocide, and the ongoing impact in terms of not responding to family violence in those communities is a part of that picture. So thank you so much for, I know you're talking about Chile, but it's so relevant.
No, but it's, and then I just reflected back in that when I'm talking about Chile, I'm also mainly, when it comes to these statistics, it's the same all around the world. It's First Nations women, Mapuche women from, you know, the center or south of Chile that are also experiencing, you know, the brunt of this same activity of, I don't know if you like or dislike the term toxic masculinity, but, you know, this form of violence, this form of violent mentality, this mentality of control, of oppression, of forcefulness, you know, these things that show up in our lives in day-to-day ways that don't necessarily cause us to commit a crime or to commit a violent act against somebody, you know, outside of ourselves, but these forms of mentality that are in essence colonial forms of mentality that we take over, that we, you know, put the flag on the top of the mountain, that we conquer, you know, these types of ideals that we have ingrained. I know as a man, I have ingrained in me that can at their worst definitely cause trauma and pain and violence towards other people and usually women. And at their best, they are, you know, maybe a little bit competitive or, you know, you want to achieve or, you know, they linger in us in subtle ways that are celebrated by society. You know, to get more money, to get more success, to conquer an industry, to conquer a, you know, whatever it might be, to win, to get, you know, to take over. These types of words are celebrated mostly in our society. And they really do, even just linguistically, the way we talk, they really do underpin a lot of the violent behavior that we're talking about as well.
I feel like we've dived so deep.
So good.
We're in it now.
This is what I needed.
The drivers of violence in society, toxic masculinity, the idea of conquering other, absolutely, ownership over another body, and it's often a female body, ownership by men over other men and their women. And what we see happening in the invasion of societies throughout history, war, is the greatest cause of sexual violence against women and then femicide. Given that women have been seen as properties of men, the best way that a man can hurt another man is to damage his most prized possession, which is, the women in their lives.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Crazy. Amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much, Hala.
Thank you, Luca. You know, it's just always a pleasure. And I love your work. I love your art. You are a creative genius. And
now that you've been working with me for the past, seeing me have my freakouts over the past few weeks, now you can.
I think Michael Jackson and how he worked. you don't create something so amazing and powerful unless you freak out along the way. You've seen freakouts leading up to today.
Totally.
About social media mostly, but
amazing. Well, the poem is called Letter to My Daughter. The video comes out today, which is the 25th of November 2020, but it will be, since most people will be listening to this later, It will be on YouTube and my Facebook and the Institute of Nonviolence, all the socials and the websites. And, you know, I'll put some details in the description box of this podcast episode. Much love, Hala. See you again soon. Peace, everybody.
Ciao.
A letter to my daughter. You are the sound of a bird's wings unfurling, the twitching of feathers hovering above the shadows. Shimmering light reflecting off the waves in the Bay of Hope. And when you were born and you grow up, I will have to bring to you a warning. There will be men who bring shotgun tongues into peaceful houses, who drink just to float with the empty bottles above their own histories, who carry manhood like a dead wolf slain across their shoulders. Men who say the shortest distance between two opinions is a clenched fist, who frequent bars just to speak to each other in voices louder than their own demons. No man can shout louder than his demons. My daughter, there will be men who take maximum credit for making minimum effort. My daughter, if history teaches us anything, your great-great-grandmother visits me in dreams. She's always wearing black. She appears to me with ghosts of women who were stoned in the villages, who were burned in town squares, abandoned by their husbands or exiled by their fathers. Women who had to raise sons who they knew would one day raise their fists against the town's daughters. Proyeyasu, she tells me, every man must face his forefather's sins willfully, unpack the boxes of false prophets, unpick the patterns of power, unball his fists, decorate his own palms in heritage and humility, or risk a forced reckoning. My daughter, I've seen my own karma as a man, frozen like a tsunami mid-surge above the roof of our house. I've seen the wounded inheritance, the hurt I've caused etched beneath my skin. My mistakes sit like sediment heavy in my lungs, and I'm still learning how to speak them. But you're the sound of a bell chiming, the sound of the universe turning in a spiral. And your great-great-grandmother visits me in dreams. She's always wearing black, but she is always turning soil, sowing seeds in the dirt for you, helping us cultivate a clean tomorrow.